Hey, I'm Brandon Monk Munoz, artist and founder of Monkwood Studios, and this is my startup story.
Every wildfire began with a spark. Every superhero has an origin story, and every single startup has a moment that they point to as their beginning, and every founder has a purpose that drove them in the midst of all obstacles. That is the startup story. The startup story would not be possible if it wasn't for the support of our sponsor, MoboCash. Move money like a miracle with MoboCash, the free money app that kicks cash. Download MoboCash app on iTunes or Google Play today, and you'll get your slick new Mobo card in the mail. You are no longer dependent upon digital currency alone, but you'll have a card that allows you to purchase at POS stations, restaurants, buy online, anywhere that you want to use your money. No credit check, no credit impact, quick direct deposit, FDIC insured, and free to register and activate. Support our sponsor, MoboCash. Visit mobo.cash or thestartupstory.co/mobocash. Before we jump into this week's episode, I want to share a review that was left on Apple Podcast. It's titled Bingeable Podcast, and it was left by Inspiro Brands. It's rated 5-star and reads, "I'm always looking for new podcasts that are inspiring and relevant. I specialize in working with startup restaurants, so this one hits close to home. The quality and content is great, and James has a great tone and interview style. I've only listened to the one with Zach Knickerbocker so far, but if you need a bit of motivation about business and life, be sure to check it out. I cannot wait to listen to other past episodes, and I'm looking forward to seeing what comes next." Wow. Thank you, Inspiro Brands, and I hope you'll reach out with your thoughts on any other episode you've listened to since then. If you have found value in any of the Startup Story episodes, please leave a review. In fact, I will continue to read one review each week, so plug your brand in the review as well. Now let's jump into this week's episode. This is a special episode for me because I'm an enormous fan of incredibly creative individuals, as well as people that have the gift of craftsmanship, especially woodworking. I am not a handy individual, so it is easy for me to admire the work of another. It's a skill I hope to develop in my retirement years, but until then, I've got a podcast to develop. Our guest today is Brandon Munoz, the founder of Monkwood Studios. Brandon is an absolute artist of various mediums, but the company he has built develops some of the most beautiful studio desks and tables you will ever see. His Instagram account is one that you will find easy to scroll for days on end. You should check it out at Monkwood_. Again, Monkwood, M-O-N-K, wood with an underscore at the end. You are in for a great treat with this episode because, like many incredibly creative people, his storytelling is spectacular. In fact, in the editing process, we had to dial down my laughing a bit because Brandon had me in hysterics at moments. In this episode, you will hear how hard it can be to leverage your creativity to make a living. You will see how critical it is to stay within proximity of others who are doing what you want to do so you can learn from them and find the courage to start your own venture. You will understand that every founder's journey has numerous points of restarting and even resetting entirely, but that every founder's journey keeps going. Brandon's story is one of exploration and self-understanding, but let's be clear. Brandon knew he was a creator from a very early time in his life, but what he didn't know was exactly how far his ability to create would take him. In fact, Brandon has been commissioned to create studio desks for some of the biggest names in entertainment industry. People like, well, I'm not going to spoil this one. I won't say anymore. I'm just going to let Brandon share his journey.
Well, growing up in suburban Southern California, it was different in the 80s, like where there's... It really started with being an artist. It was about being an artist, and it kind of every kid, I believe, is an artist. But I kind of knew I was since childhood to now is a fight to continue that and get more into that. But two parents, they were really cool. They weren't entrepreneurs. My mother was a social worker in adoption and care, and my dad was a loan officer, still is. He's a pretty good one, helping people get home loans. And my sister, she's an artist. So both of us, me and my sister, just had the bug, but they just fully supported it. They let me paint my room whatever color I wanted it. I eventually did a Jimi Hendrix mural. Like that took up one whole side of it because I was really into him when I was like 13.
You were 13 and you played a Jimi Hendrix mural.
Yeah, because my dad's records had gotten to Led Zeppelin and Jimi Hendrix. That's awesome. Like, so it had a big impact on because then I got in playing guitar and then just started exploring all different types, but I wanted to be a painter. So just kind of staying in the childhood area for now, it's like building dirt jumps on bikes, building ramps. It was my first woodworking experience and just building some sketchy, real crazy ramps that hurt a lot of people, you know? And yeah, just those adventures that we went on in the 80s when you can, and growing up in high school in the 90s, there was just a lot more. It was a different type of childhood. I mean, you could go out and
yeah,
it was less monitoring. There was no social media. So you were bored, you had to figure something out. So yeah. I spent most of my high school, like a lot, you know, in my room playing guitar and just creating stuff. And so I'm now a furniture maker. I'll stay in childhood, but I started hacking desks when I was like 12, like my Aaron Brothers art desk.
Okay.
I started making it to fit my 4-track cassette recorder. I started drilling holes into it to route the wires and just kind of make it, putting speakers in the weird spots. So I started making studio desks when I was like a teenager.
So you've been a creator your whole life, basically. I mean, I'm sure if you can even go back to even before your teens, you think of things that you were creating.
Well, this shark that's behind me in my shop, that's the first thing I started drawing was sharks and whales when I was like 7, when my parents took me to SeaWorld, and that was it. I was just drawing sharks and whales all the time, like just getting books on them, drawing them, learning about the different kinds. I want to be like an oceanographer. But I think what's crazy to me now is like all the lines, I mean, I can draw different types of sharks by memory, but those lines, they find their way into the things I make all the time. You know, oh, I'm awesome. Looking at them going, whoa, that's like a, you know, that's a dorsal fin right there. All, you know, just, yeah. It's always there. But the inspiration of it, I mean, and it's coming back to me now, you know, I'm starting to do paintings that have, I see in the wood, I see like sea creatures and different things. So it's all tied together. Yeah. I think your inclinations as a child are a huge key to what your passion really is. And it's just repeating themes, and you just gotta, it's the fight to keep them alive is the tough thing. Cause you know, adult life is all about like responsibility and making it work for good reasons. But then you feel empty as being totally responsible and having everything. But what's the emptiness based on this? So it's going to always be a struggle. But I think my childhood influences have just, I've kept them running with them and just seeing where they go. And so
that's awesome that your parents gave you that freedom to explore your creativity a bit too, because it doesn't sound, unless your parents had like a hobby in creativity, their careers were not that.
No, they weren't, but they're definitely, they were very, just not supportive, encouraging for it. You know, like my dad got me a Stratocaster guitar when I was like 10, and like I still have it. I gave it to my son when he was 10, but I still play it because he's still in the house. But he was just always behind that, like whatever the next thing was. And it may have looked like I was jumping around, but I was just always like, it wasn't about the medium. It was just about like finding and...
Yeah. What did you want to be in high school, though?
Somewhere a filmmaker, stuntman, magician.
No, these were real things.
Oh yeah, just no. Like what was it? I forget what they called that when we were seniors. That senior part, like you can go
a career day or something.
Yeah, something.
Like that.
I was looking into magicians. And musicians, like I wanted to go visit Mario C, the producer for Beastie Boys. And this was still when it was analog produced. This was before like anybody can make a beat on their laptop type of days. And like, so me and my friends, they'd come to my house and I had a studio and we just make hundreds of songs, like literally after school, just like, and then later on it would just be like, I just set up a session where you record like 20 songs, just improvised, and I'd have all the mics just kind of like this, just set up and just to capture something. And it usually would, you know, and then we got into some like crazy partying. But I wanted to pursue the art, so I went to art school. I finally went to Otis College of Art and Design and went there for a year.
Where is that located?
It's in LA.
Okay.
Now it's in West LA, what it was in downtown LA. When I went there, at 19, it was like before downtown was like a safe place you could walk your dog at night. It was a different downtown in like late 90s. It was by MacArthur Park. So like I had an apartment across MacArthur Park, and Otis was on the other side of MacArthur Park. And it was a foundation year. So you're learning life drawing, you're doing, learning all like the foundation years of like how to compose. And like, it's really, it's intense. And then I'd walk home through MacArthur Park to my crappy apartment in off of Alvarado. And I put on this like limp, like this, and like just this crazy face because there's people just huddled together smoking crack. And it was just, but I enjoyed the experience nonetheless. It was just really cool to just be in a different place than Orange County. So I was just like, I was thriving on that. I used to go to Venice Beach a lot. Mm-hmm. I eventually moved to Venice Beach where it's just an artist haven, a mecca, you know, for weirdos. And like, and I just loved it. You know, I would just go hang out and talk to the people that were doing the shows on a, you know, on weekends when they're doing the boardwalk entertainment. Like on Tuesday to be practicing, like there's a chainsaw guy juggling chainsaws over this guy's face, but he would pretend on the weekend it looked like he's picking some guy out of a crowd to do it, but they were practicing on Tuesday, you know. I was like watching their routine, you know, and I just got like some gleaning more influence on like a lot of the spray can artists in Venice Beach. I learned more about myself through by bouncing myself off others, and I think that's a way we really find out about us is just like meeting all kinds of people. And
so did you go to Otis straight out of high school? So like
I went to a junior college for a bit.
Okay.
And that was kind of like, it was kind of a step because it was a, you know, private school, cost a lot of money, but I went there for a year. And while I was going to Otis, I got a job at a little small furniture company. And it was run by a guy, a friend from high school, who's older than me. His name was John Green. And he was an actor, a working actor in Hollywood, getting parts and TV shows and whatnot, but he decided to start building furniture because his family owned several furniture stores in LA. And he's just like, hey, I'll start making stuff. And instead of being a waiter, I'll just build furniture. And so he was getting orders and it was going well. So he started hiring friends from high school to come and finish the stuff, like sand it.
Yeah.
And it was pine furniture built with nail guns and glues. So it wasn't like super crafty. It was really strong though. It was like real wood. It was really tough stuff. He would climb the bookcase shelves just to show how strong they were. And so, yeah, we would be finishing these really, they're rustic pine, you know, so it was just sand it, throw some Bryowax on it. He didn't even give us any gloves or anything. It was just like, we're inhaling it. Our hands were melting. Then eventually he started showing me how to build some things because he saw I had a inclination for it, but it seemed like magic to me at the beginning. I didn't like, so how are you doing this? I just saw him chopping away. He was listening to Rage Against the Machine all the time, and just like, he had literally like throwing knives that he'd practice with. He'd just get really amped up and just start throwing the knives at an old bookcase. And yeah, he was an intense guy. So we'd go on these Home Depot trips, supply runs, and he'd give me these pep talks. He was like my Tony Robbins. He's like, yeah, this world is just producers and consumers. You got to choose who you're going to be, you know? It's just, and he just, I was just quiet, you know, naive, like, oh my God. It felt like you know,
22
movie,
maybe, how old at this time?
I was like, you know, 1920.
1920, okay.
And it's the same time I was going to Otis. Yeah. And he's just, you know, really out there and really intense and really hilarious too. Like he'd say some speeches like, based on the song on the radio. He's like smoking like two joints on the way to Home Depot. And I'm like, it felt like training day, you know, like, and like, I'm just sitting there like watching him and he's telling me about life.
Man up.
And he's like, you're that song. It says they want a ton of hoes. What does that mean? What does that mean? How much is a ton of hoes? Like how many hoes are in a ton? And he starts breaking it down. Well, you got to know what kind of hoes you like. I'm like, what? And then like, but he was just talking about making, like, don't just aim for nothing. It's like, know what you want, go and get it. And like, I was like, okay, man. But he was like a big brother I didn't have because I was just me and my sister. And like, I didn't have that guy just telling me how it is. But he taught me how to build. And he taught me how to build I remember this speech he had, like, I'm gonna show you how to build a nightstand in 15 minutes. And he tried to do it 15 minutes. Eventually took 45 and he was getting mad. He was like, oh yeah, my saw screwed up, you know. But it was just his enthusiasm just rubbed off on me. And it's like, I have it to this day. And like, I have apprentices coming now. And like, I don't give him the ton of hoes speech, but I definitely give him some monologues, you know, that come from these experiences with John Green. And to this day, you know, I thank him for it because I would not be building furniture without it. Yeah. I mean, he taught me how to build a bookcase. He taught me how to build a nightstand. I eventually started doing custom orders. And then it was kind of, he let me on my own to try while he was going on audition. And I get a call and say like, hey man, I need you to build this dresser. It's kind of, and he'd give me dimensions over the phone and like, man, I never built this before. And he'd be like, what are you, you know, like, just build it, man. And just like, then he'd come back and I'd have it all wrong. And he'd like, ah, what'd you do? And just, but he's just, he just kind of broke the ice for me, you know, yeah. Like, hey, like, you could just try. And because yeah. He wasn't building mastercrafted stuff, but he was building nonetheless. Yeah. And it was going out there and getting sold and bought. Yeah. And there was there's transactions being made. And, you know, I remember I got some acting lessons from him too. Like, he's like, he'd give me the phone. He's like, pretend you're Jose. You're delivering this furniture and you don't speak much English. You're stuck on the freeway and you're going to be there in 2 hours. You know, and like hola, me. And it's Jose. I'll be there. You know, like, and eventually it kind of, I felt the call to like go on my own, you know, yeah. And like, it was just, but before I did that, I had got a job opportunity at Jim Henson's Creature Shop, special effects house of Jim Henson's.
That's
and it's
awesome.
In Burbank. And this was around the same time, 20, and I decided to drop out of art school. It's like, you know, partly because I thought I didn't need it, you know, and part of me regrets not getting a degree. Part of me also like is thankful that I took a different turn, but I felt like it was just time to just, you know, just go for it. And I thought I was really into the movies and filmmaking and thought, yeah. They were working on a movie called Jack Frost at the time with Michael Keaton. And we made all this, I helped make the snowmen. I worked in the mold department and I was a carpenter. And like, they just tell me to make like some weird apparatus that they're building molds on. And it was just another kind of deep end experience in just not knowing what I'm doing, but like having enough skills to get me by. And then my supervisor at the time, his name was Phil Jackson. He was a British guy from Camden Town, London. And like, Brandon, I need you to make this like Marquis de Sade fantastic unit. I'm going to put a snowman head on there. I need to strap it down. I need it to be strong, mate. You need just, and he just like draw this little sketch and then just build it for him. He's like, brilliant, mate. You know, like, and then just on to the next thing. He's like, it was an intense environment. You know, those guys, they were like, the mold department especially, they're like a bunch of mad hatters. Like, those guys were crazy. They were shooting potato guns at lunch. So creative, just so, they had a great niche. And I gleaned from them too. You know, it was just like, wow, these people are, there's all kinds of different ways to explore your creativity. And then even there, it seemed cool. Like, I was going to do it, but then I still felt called to like, do my own thing. Mm. And so I left that.
What was that, do you think?
I mean, I don't know.
You know, because it's interesting when I hear about your childhood, you know, the magician and all the things you wanted to be, but just creating, and you were creating, right? You're not 20, you're with Jim Henson, you're creating things.
Yeah.
So what do you think that was what was the difference between what you were doing then and the idea of doing your own thing? Because you were creating.
Yeah, I think it's just, with creating, people have different takes on this. Everybody does it for different reasons, but I think it's always down to like learning more about yourself. And your work is like a mirror all the time. And it tells you where you're at this point, what you're into. Like it's shown, whether it's furniture or painting or whatever, you're like, your emotions are coming out.
Yeah.
You know, your thought process is coming out, whether it's an order or it's an assignment or it's something that just, I think every artist ultimately wants to do exactly what they want to do. I mean, that seems like a pie in the sky sometimes, but I'm still aiming for that, getting closer and closer. But you find that as you acquire skills and hone your craft or crafts, and then what I find is that wanting to do your own thing is just, it's just expressing yourself, just being you. And
so it's just another level of creating, really.
Yeah, it's just another level. It's freedom. Yeah. Like, yeah, there's a freedom to it. There's a joy. I mean, when you're creating and doing, because the joy is just taking you straight back to childhood when it didn't, when it was just, it didn't matter. You weren't doing it for an award. You're just doing it. You're just, you know, and it's kind of just, and I believe that a lot of who we were was already there in childhood. It's just playing itself out.
Yeah.
You know, we grow and learn and discover more about ourselves, but we ultimately just find out we already knew,
yeah,
like back then.
Yeah.
And also a big thing that happened around this time is that I was kind of got in this exploration. You know, we're doing a lot of smoking a lot of weed, doing a lot of mushrooms, just trying to find that next thing. And I just kind of took it really far and almost like went a bit crazy, you know, like almost like hit I was pretty much schizophrenic for a little while. And then I discovered a Bible that I had, it was given to me when I was 7, and it was, and it kind of opened, reawakened a lot of things in me. And then basically, yeah, I became a believer in Christ around 21. And I was basically healed from schizophrenia. Like, I thought I was in a video game at some point. So it got really intense, you know, all this checking different things out and going to, it's just, I took it to the point where it's like, wow, I'm grateful to not be walking the earth or in a straitjacket somewhere, because it got pretty close to that. And that's where like creativity can like, it can kind of,
without boundaries, it just kind of takes you to certain places.
Or without guidance, you know, or without a vision, just experiencing just for the sake of it can take you some like weird places and some scary places. So with that, I kind of moved back to Orange County. I was kind of like regrouping. I'd lost a lot of money. It was just like kind of, my parents, there they were to let me kind of restart again. And it was like, hey, can I build furniture in your garage? You know, and it was like, okay. They let me do that for a couple of years, just get back on my feet. And I just started saying yes to a bunch of orders, learned, totally got a lot of more experiences, a lot of failures. This is where like, not just that failure of, I think a lot of people go out and then come back home. That's just normal now. It's like you go out and come back to parents and figure yourself out again. And then this, in this new round, there were good failures of like trying, you know, pricing something way too low and then making nothing, or, you know, or, you know, I built, saying yes to everything. Yeah, I could do the kitchen cabinets. I could refinish them for you and just totally screwing it up, or, but also trying new things like building a door or just trying, just, this is where my woodworking really started to take off. It was, I sought this mentor out in LA. His name was Steve Casey. He was building entertainment centers for like rich movie stars and stuff. And I was just, this was around like now 2000, 2002, the internet, like no woodwork. He was like one of the only woodworkers with a website. You know, I was just like, I found him like, hey man, like do you mind me coming for a day? And he just took me, he just,
I mean, the second guy, a woodworker with a website, like, is Bob Villa, right?
Yeah, yeah. he was in Agoura Hills, and he had this house in Agoura Hills and a workshop right next to it that he built. He was like living this, to me, a dream life. He just walked to his workshop and just build all day and then walk home. And he was into motorcycles. And it's like, now I started to see a vision of like what things could be. He had like this little drawing room, and he was telling me about, you know, like some of the projects he did for people. And he just spent one day with me. But like that day kind of totally diverted. I mean, totally gave me something to aim for.
When you think of that day, when you think of that one day, what was that day like for you?
It was just kind of like, I had all these collections of failures and ideas, still a bunch of ideas. And I'm now in my early 20s, college dropout. Like, am I going to go back to college? What am I going to do? Is there something to this woodworking thing? Yeah. Is there like, because for then it was just like, it's just so I didn't have to go work at Starbucks or get another regular job. You know, it was kind of an escape at some point, but also like, is there something to this? And he was proof that there was. I mean, he also told me it was very hard, and that he was an artist too himself, but he was a trained woodworker and went to some of those fine schools, but also a very down-to-earth guy, and who just found a niche. And then that's where the idea about the niche came to me. Like, you know, he's just decided to just focus on entertainment centers. And these were the ones that were like, you know, back when big screens were like, you know, 6 feet thick. And so I started making those too. But what I learned through that, it's not so much the thing you make. It's like, it's how you make it, because now all those entertainment centers are obsolete and they're just like, they're, who knows what happened to them. I actually went into a thrift store in 2010, I think it was 2010, and I saw an entertainment center I made in 2003 in the thrift store for $250 bucks. And I sold it for like $5,000 back then, but like it was a walnut, and the wood alone was worth more than $250. But it was kind of like, whoa, hit me like, wow, like you got to really think about what you're making, if it's, especially if it's, if you want it to last. It would, like, it was in great condition, but it just didn't make sense anymore. Yeah. So that's where I started really thinking about design, like what's going to make sense in 50 years, what's going to make sense in 100 years, and start not. Because I guess that thing of the artist in me, I want things to matter. I want things to last. I want things to be here when I'm gone, you know, that kind of thing. So around this time was really just about, can I be an artist? And then a left field kind of thing came my way. Well, I decided to get married. There was an opportunity to go to England to be youth pastors. And we decided, let's go for it. You know, we don't have another plan. I was kind of like, kind of scared of now having to, you know, be married and figure out how to pay rent, not just a truck payment, you know, and really get that going. So part of it was like, oh, this sounds like a great idea. You know, like I can just go out there and figure all this other stuff later. But we went out there, and like 7 years later, we're church planting in an area called Camden Town, which was like the Venice Beach. Mm-hmm. It is the Venice Beach of London. And all the characters, all the beautiful mix of people from all races, all cultures. And that's, being in London, like, really affected me, because I just got to know people, not just, just people from everywhere, and like what that means. And I was, you know, technically a minister, so I was sharing the gospel, but I felt like a lot of these people just imparted so much more into me about like what human beings are, and what, like, God spoke a lot to me about what it really means to minister, and like, and that, how it really be, means to be human. It's just, it's not something you can just, like, you don't just hit a switch in somebody, you know, you just, you gotta be completely you for them to be, have any, for you to have any effect on anybody.
You gotta be authentic, for sure.
Yeah, and it's also, you gotta be transparent. You just gotta be, so I try to do as much of that, but I also learned in the pastoral, like, there's a weight to it where you feel like you have to put on. I mean, we all do that to some degree in adult life. There's a persona to it, and but we had just a small church all the time. It never got very big, but there was always, there's people's lives did get changed. You know, I saw some miracles. I saw some. Had a lot of heartaches, like a lot of frustration. So I would call it almost like my, apart from the garage business, like that was kind of like a startup with training wheels.
Yeah.
This was like another startup experience, since I was trying to start a church. And it was, and you're always trying to compare it to bigger churches or better things or more established. And like, we were always just kind of small and fluid, you know, almost like guerrilla style. We're always changing our meeting spot, and I always felt like that was, it was so exhausting, but it was kind of freeing that we didn't always, that we got to be very fluid, and it didn't require a lot of overhead apart from our living expenses, which we were being supported as missionaries. But the randomness that could occur in a church service was just unreal sometimes. You know, there would be people who would be come in totally drunk, or people would bring in their dogs, or people like just off the street, and it wouldn't be disruptive because like everybody was used to this stuff. You know, it wasn't like, oh my God, what's going on? It's just like, oh, yes, there's another person. Go get him a cup of tea, and then like show him where to sit, and you know, we'll talk to him later. And we had a, it was like central, you know, north central London. So there's, it was a lot of unique experiences with people. And what's cool about it too is I also had a wood shop at this time. Our landlord had, he was a wealthy guy around town, and he owned a furniture company. I just walked in and said if I could talk to the owner, if I could rent a, you know, wood shop space somewhere, because they were building, I saw them building furniture, and this is in London. And eventually I got to meet the owner. He's like, that's cool what you guys are doing out here. You know, young people need a message of hope. And you, do you need a, he's like, yeah, you can. I'll give you the keys to my shop. He had a little private wood shop under a train bridge. Okay. You know, like it was awesome tools. Like, so it was like, it was really weird because it was the, and he also became our landlord. He's like, yeah, you guys need a place to live. You know, I got a great apartment, you know, if you guys are up for rent. And he was like the open door to London for us. And I know I'm not speaking very linear, but what the, I think the thread is that, you know, it was the woodworking that got opened the door there while I was doing ministry, you know, which was really weird. And I also brought people in to do, some of the church members to do building projects because I felt like building with them was just a great, it's just good. You're not just like sitting down talking on coffee. Like that gets old after a while, you know, just like talking about issues, you know, just when you're building something, you're just doing something together. And it's like, it's creating together is a whole nother aspect that is.
It sounds like those years in London were incredibly transformative for you. So obviously we are not recording this in London right now.
Yeah,
so what brought you back?
Oh, just pure exhaustion, you know, like people exhaustion. Because I'm basically an introvert and having to be an extrovert like all the time just started weigh on me. And my wife, we had three kids, being a new parent. And she's always been on the adventure with me. And like we came back, decided to come back after 7 years. And we left, I gave away all my tools, sold some and a lot of music equipment, all the things we'd acquired in 7 years. We just came back with suitcases and said, we're going to start again. And
How old were you at this
now
time?
I was like 32.
32. Okay.
So most of my mid to late 20s were in England.
So 32, married with three kids.
Yeah.
And so, just suitcases with your goods.
Yeah. And thankfully, my grandparents had a house that was, they had a, recently, those passed away, and then we could rent that house and kind of get started again. So I was back in a garage building furniture because no one was hiring ex-missionary art school dropouts for anything. You know, I was like,
that's
quite
a resume at that point.
Great, you were in England. How was that? Well, that has no relevance to this job. You know, like it was scary, very scary, because now I have to do it.
Yeah,
now it's like, I'm not being an entrepreneur by choice. I'm doing it because of, I need to do this. Like I tried to get other jobs.
Well, let's put a date on that. Cause if you're
this
talking
2010.
32. Okay. 2010. So after the worst recession in
it's right in the middle of it. Really? There's this like who knows when the worst part of it, but it was still, there was no upswing yet.
Got it.
And around this time, there was a lot of people who lost jobs and were starting to become makers because they had to, you know, and there's a lot of people out there that were doing this, building stuff out of pallets because it was free, you know, like, and like, I know a lot of these people and this is what we did. And it was, a lot of people found something new out of this like void. And eventually as things started to turn, it was like, we just had to figure, I had to decide at this point, I knew how to build things, but I didn't know how to build them like in a way that, like I said, I always thought being a woodworker and building furniture was just a means to an end. Like I could make a living. I could always do something new. And then I started to think about like, well, what would it be like if I actually did this very well? And like, how would that look? And what could that bring? And that's where I started really digging into the craft and not just, you know, slamming it together, getting nice, sanding it pretty well and all the tricks I learned and, you know, in the nightstand days, it was now like, I'm going to really think about which kind of wood I use and what, and start exploring different things. That's where I started using poplar, which is a very, like right behind here, it's you see it starts green and it's called paint grade and I always see it and I started seeing a beauty to it and by accident I discovered that it tans when you put it in the sun. After you put a little oil, I mean, it's just a natural thing it does over time, but I was like, wow, this. So I started selling poplar pieces and now it's like the most ordered thing I do is suntan poplar. And a lot of woodworkers, you know, kind of look down and like, oh, it's a soft wood and, you know, it shouldn't be, it's crappy wood. But like, because it's not as hard as a walnut, but I have this now, I really totally believe in, I want to make things that look better when they get older. Like, they're supposed to get old. They're supposed to tell a story. They're supposed to not like look new in 50 years, but they're still solid. They're still well-made. They're still beautiful. They're actually more beautiful. That's why I like poplar. And I use walnut. I use mahogany. I use all the nicer woods, but I started to build up my wood vocabulary, started using reclaimed a lot more, but not just, I started mixing the different things. So now I have I started coming up with my own way of doing things in woodworking. And that's, it takes a while to figure that out. And and at this time I started to fuse things. And this is where all these experiences start to come. And I always thought I was just a random guy just bouncing around from lily pad to lily pad. And it was like, now I had to really, you have to really focus now and like figure out what's your thing. And like, I don't want to just say yes to everything.
Yeah.
Cause that's exhausting. That's totally exhausting. I don't have like,
but now you know, you're married, you have three kids.
Yeah,
so the idea of saying yes though, that means there's money on the other side.
Yes. So, but that's where it's risky. Now it's like, okay. Like I started saying yes because I had to. I built like, you know, this Murphy bed. I almost like shot myself with that one. Like the bed that folds down. And it was, I couldn't just chalk everything up to a learning experience. I mean, as a way to make myself feel better.
Yeah. You
know, everything is learning experience, but like I need to get paid now. So what could be my specialty? And I designed this studio desk. There was an acquaintance I had in LA. He was like, hey, can you build me this desk for my apartment? And he lived in downtown. And it's like, yeah, I'm a guitarist. And it's like, I started putting some thought into it and looking around. It's like, you know what? There's a lot of these studio desks out there, but no one's really like making them out of all hard wood, like really nice, like really, like where it's like, there's obviously using wood elements and they're very cool looking utilitarian, but I wanted something like classy. Like, what would that look like? And so I started, made my first prototype, sold it to him, and then learned a lot from that one. Now my learning experience, now I was changing it a little bit every time I made it. So now I was
just refining.
Now I had a design. Yeah. Now I have like several designs, but they're all based on things I've learned when I was 14, hacking my desk. They're like, what would, like in design, you have to tell people you're thinking about them. Like when they look at that, they go, oh, they're answering a question that they have an answer for the question that I had. Yeah. Like, how do I get all this over here? And this, you know, you have to just speak a different, it's a visual language. That's what design is. And it's got to be inspiring. And that's, I think wood is for humans that it's a very inspiring material. I mean, we've made instruments, we've made utensils, we made weapons, we made houses, you know, all throughout history. And it always keeps coming back, even though we have plastics and steel, all these composite materials now. It's like, why can you get an iPhone holder made out of wood? Because people just want, it's a presence to it, you know, that it's something about it. And so my wife encouraged me, like, I started making designs for our home that became the dining tables that were the first orders on Etsy, and then these studio desks. And like, I just started specializing in dining tables and desks and benches and stopped saying yes to everything and just saying, no, I'm going to make this, put it out there. Do you want to buy it? And this is where that, I believe, caught on because it was coming from me. It wasn't just, I was, oh, that's going to be a hot seller. Let's do that. Then this is, that doesn't inspire me. That doesn't wake me up in the morning. It doesn't keep me going, you know, for a 10, 12 hour day. It's like, oh, this is what's hot. You know, like it doesn't matter.
It sounds like at that time is when you really started discovering your own personal brand.
Yeah. Yeah. Right? And it's based on all your inclinations, your personalities, the music you like, the colors you like.
So now when people are buying your product, they're buying really a piece of you. They're buying your creation and the thought that goes into it, right? They're not buying something, or are they buying something by spec saying, I want this piece?
I definitely offer that. So I came up with the studio desk I designed. I started breaking it down, started getting more thoughtful about which parts, like how do I streamline this process? And I'm still in that process because I want to learn how to hand it over and get other people to help me do this and get it out of my head, you know? But it's a flexible design. It's like a car. You know, you can order a Corvette. You can get it, you're red. You can get it, you know, with, you know, what kind of wheels do you want? What kind of engine? It's kind of that type of thing. It's like, you can get it this way, that way. It's like, that's what the studio desks have become. It's like, it's a flexible design that can be personal to the client, but also it's very unique to what I do. It's like, you don't just see it anywhere.
And that's one of the reasons I reached out to you is for those on Instagram, which is the, pretty much almost everyone in the known universe, Monkwood Studios is your Instagram account, mm-hmm. correct?
Oh, yeah, it's just Monkwood _ because somebody with Monkwood that doesn't use it has
so,
it.
So Monkwood _. And you can see some of Brandon's pieces, but they're absolutely beautiful and they're so unique and so stunning. And you can definitely see the art side of your mm-hmm. woodworking. And there's definitely an artistry to it. Is that the case across the board for woodworkers?
It's woodworking's a journey. Any craft is a journey. And I don't, like I said, if I was at one point in my life, it was a means to an end. At another point, it was just, oh, it's a cool way to be creative. Another point, it was like, I need to do this to make money. So everybody's at a different point. Yeah. Woodworking can be a great escape for somebody who sits at a desk job. Woodworking can be a lot of different things for different people. For me, it is art. You know, I do see what it can be, the way it can speak to people and the way it can not just be furniture, but actually very functional, but very artful, you know, at the same time. And it was around this time that like, yeah, I start, and it's even the people I connect with, like who started buying these desks, like, it was more like, oh, wow, these are kind of like my type of people. Like we have such a different level of connection. It's not just a transaction. Like some of these stories I hear about even people who bought dining tables or like what it means to their family or the desk, like they're making a jump in their sphere, in their realm. And they're like, and I'm as a craftsman making a jump too. And we're kind of at that same spot. And I have what's called like a Legend of Zelda business theory. And if you're old enough to remember the first Legend of Zelda, and I think it plays out in the other games, but like when you're ready for the silver sword, you have to like burn the right bush to find the guy who makes the silver sword. And he's got it there for you. You got to be ready for him. You have to have gone through enough battles to earn that one. And when you have that, but you're at the right point and he can't make that sword until he's ready. You know, so you meet people. I'm basically making the silver, the gold sword for somebody who's ready for it. I'm not trying to compete now with, I'm not trying to bargain with people. Yeah. I mean, I'm also not trying to, they cost much more than the other desks out there, but if they saw what went into these, you know, there's a lot of passion just as they put into their work when they're making, it's a lot of musicians, film composers. And I started, one of the craziest things that happened to me was I've built for famous people and once in a while I get an email and you know, some famous people are like, oh, can you do it like next week? You know, because I'm famous or I can do. And I just go, sorry, you know, I can't.
Yeah.
This is it. But when they meet me on that level, it's like, I really like what you do. Can we somehow make it work? And one day I got a email from James Hetfield from Metallica's sound guy. He's like, yeah, James is building a studio. He really likes your stuff. And I remember it's like, where did you see it? He was on Etsy. I was like, I can't mention James Hetfield on Etsy. But he went, this listing that he liked was, I remember this desk. It was like a wood, I was using poplar and it was a darker, it was a more, it had these black streaks on it. And I remember building, oh, this is a bit too much. It's kind of crazy. It's like, it looks very, almost sinister, just like, and I took some photos of it that were kind of dark and foreboding. And I was like, I put it up there. I was like, yeah, no one's going to want, people are like, maybe some goth out there is going to want it. But then it's James Hetfield calls up and he wants that desk. And well, I thought in my mind, his assistant said, well, he wants to know if he can expedite it. And I said, oh, sorry, because I had like a bunch of orders already. I can't, that'll just drive my life crazy. I didn't so much say that. I just said, no, it's going to be the same wait. And
yeah.
I didn't hear from him for a few weeks. I thought, oh, it was a done deal. But then he called and says, yeah, James wants to wait and he wants to talk to you about it. So he called me up and you know, says, yeah, it's James Hetfield. And I'm like, wow, hell, how are you doing, man?
Like, were you able to play that off, like play it cool? Or did you totally go,
you have to.
Did you go fanboy in it?
No, you just like, it just, he's such a cool guy. You know, he doesn't, after a while, you forget you're talking to him. He's just saying, yeah, I just need something to write songs. I just get my guitar, plug it in, hook it to my computer. And because in my head, I had this sales pitch for the ultimate like metal desk in the world. Like I was like, if I make a desk for James Hetfield, it's going to look like, it's going to be charred black with steel and look like a Gibson SG. And like, and I was trying to throw this pitch in there. And after he told me his specs, it's like, James, you know, really glad that you like my stuff. You know, I just, so you know, I can make you the most metal desk you've ever seen in your life. And he just like laughed at me and he's like, no, just keep it classy, man.
That's awesome.
So that's what I did. And I made it and delivered it. And as far as I know, he's writing songs on it, you know? So that's...
Just out of curiosity, have you reached out to him to know what songs have been written on that desk?
No, I don't want to... Like, he's such a... The thing is with him, he's taking me back to child. Like, I was 11 and I got my first Metallica tape. Yeah. And I've learned, I don't know how many of his songs. So this is not just a famous person. This is like somebody stepping out of the storybook. And like, it was really trippy. And it's like, I just wanted to provide a good service, give him what he wanted. And I didn't deliver it. I was thinking, should I deliver myself? But I had a friend of mine deliver it. And he said he really dug it. And I also sent a gift. This weird offcut. It looked like this. It was in the poplar. It looked like a goblin, and I just gave it to him. And it's just thank you for his inspiration to me. And I told him, like, gave him with a disclaimer. If you don't like it, you can just use it a Halloween decoration. But I was told that he totally dug it. Whether somebody's famous or not, that doesn't matter to me. It's just that if there's a connection, that there's a mutual appreciation, because I'm appreciating what these people are doing on my desk. And hopefully they're appreciating what this desk can do for, it's just, it's a facilitator. I mean, it's just, in the end, it's holding up your instruments. And so that's what I've learned that furniture can do. It can facilitate experiences. And the way I design certain things, where's somebody going to sit, like on a dining table, how is that arranged? You're facilitating an experience.
Yeah.
Kind of just by the way you, because there's going to be humans around this thing. And I that's why I like to make things that humans like actually are either creating at or communing at, like a dining table. Yeah. I don't get much joy out of building storage, you know, just plain where you're going to hide all your crap. Like other people might enjoy doing that, but I've done that. And I just like where those type of things, I know that they're going to influence life in some kind of way. And that's art, you know, is influencing life. And
it's just fascinating to me in hearing your story, just how deep the creator gene just runs through you, right? I mean, as you're talking about a desk, you know, for a studio desk, right? It's a tool to create. Mm-hmm. You know, you're talking about dining room tables, right? It creates memories for families. I mean, and whether you are conscious of those decisions or not, as you were thinking of those things to make, like, it is just so, it is a thread that runs through you from childhood to now. And it is so incredible to see. So I have to ask the question though, as you reflect back on your childhood, do you stand here today with a sense of awe and appreciation that, you know, you're in your 40s and you're doing what you wanted to do as a kid?
Yeah, it's definitely there's always I think in an artist, there's like I don't know when the sense of arrival happens, because I haven't got a sense of arrival. I definitely have a sense of journey and like looking back, and like, it's kind of like, I think it's, you're climbing a mountain. I don't think you ever, like, you get good views along the way, and I totally try to appreciate those views. But you also know, like, you got a long way to go, and that you're always, I am always looking back up and go, oh crap, like I got a lot to do. But looking back, I can definitely say, like, yeah, there's been hard choices and hard fought things just to keep that creative gene alive, because it's there and it's going to nag you either way until you stuff it so far down that it just doesn't have any fight left in it. But that's where, like, when I decided to build furniture again, it was just like, it was there. I go, oh, hey, here's your chance to just make stuff, or you're going to actually, I mean, that's why I designed the studio is like how it is. If you look around, it's not just, I wouldn't say, I don't know if you would, it doesn't look like a normal woodworker studio.
It's it does not.
But it tells me, like, I'm not just coming here and make some normal today. I'm just going to, like, I'm going to put it all out here. And that's the shark. It's just, it reminds me of who I am as a kid. Like, I need those reminders so I can keep that fight going, you know? And my wife is a great encouragement. My kids are a great encouragement, because like, I'm doing this for them now. It's not just for me. And getting out of that ego is one of the hardest things I've been dealing with over the last 10 years, you know, getting past that. I think that's kind of what turning 40 is about. For me, it's just like getting over that, you know, getting over that need to be a name of, it's more now it's like, what can I get away with? What can I actually do? That's like, yeah. And now I have this freedom. I know who I am. I can like, and not have to worry about what people like think in that sense. Like, I do have to still get the bread and butter buttered. You know what I mean? But now I'm like taking other bold risks of like have these paintings and these things I'm coming up with. It's like now, because my, you know, if I'm honest, like I could stop here, but I would fail if I stopped here.
Because, why do you say that?
Because, you know, I have, or if I just started cruising from here, because I know there's so many more things inside of me. There's creatures in the wood hiding out there that need to get out, and no one's going to ask. They're asking me to do it. No one's coming here and say, hey, do you got any like sharks in the wood today? You know, I have to put those out there just like I did a studio desk. And when you have to kind of put that out there, and then people see it and then they ask for more of it. So it's like, that's part of a creative entrepreneur is like, you have to take the risk to put something out there that people may or may not like. And like back in my early days, I remember going to like, you know, swap meets or like flea markets with these DVD racks and thought they were cool because I painted them red or black, and nobody bought anything, you know? And I've been through the fail, I tried to be a Venice Beach, sell stuff on Venice Beach. Nobody bought anything. But I thought it was so cool. So you have to like get that feedback, get the failure feedback, I call it. And it's not fun to look at, but that's the only way you find the real stuff is because you have to get through those. And
if you were to think back along your journey, you know, I'm a big believer that if we lose sight of the people, the shoulders that we stood upon to get to where we're at, if we lose sight of the people that poured into us in any way, shape, or form, encouraging words or guidance, mentorship, financial, whatever the case may be, if we lose sight of those people, then we're going to fail because we can't do this journey alone.
No.
So for you, like if you look back on your journey, who are the people that you look back on with just such immense gratitude because of what a role they played to where you are today?
Yeah, definitely my mother and father, you know, for their unending continued support and just like kind of knowing who I was. I mean, they're my parents, so they know who I am, but they weren't ever trying to be like, no, you should be this. They kind of like, they knew me and my sister were artists. So they've like, you know, they still have the, you know, as I do the parental, you don't want to see your kids risk and fail. You know, that's hard to watch. I'm sure it's just like watching the soccer game. My wife who's on the same boat even more, you know, my second mom, I call her that, she helped me to focus. Cause even when I came back from England, I was like, oh, I'm going to be a photographer. I'm going to do this. I'm going to that. She's like, honey, you should probably just be the wood guy, but do it really well, you know, like do it really well. And then you could do a bunch of other things after that. And I was like, yeah, I think you're probably right. And it was just like, cause I didn't own it.
Yeah.
I wasn't like being the wood guy. I didn't want to just be a carpenter. It's like I had to have this spin on it.
Yeah.
But I couldn't have found that without the focus, without the guidance. And so it's the guidance and the encouragement from her and the love. And John Green, who taught me how to build a nightstand and a dresser and blew a bunch of weed smoke in my face. You know, like I took a few hits too, but man, like, come on. His speeches like are in me, you know, you know, I've had a lot of people along the way, you know, my youth pastor, Adam, who took me around the world, you know, on those mission trips just to get that. I wouldn't have had that perspective without his influence. I would not have, the guy who started this art colony, Mike Magoski, he just decided to collect a bunch of artists together. And then the people I met in the last several years here, the artists, like, we've reflected off each other and found more about us. So it's constant. You have to just have your eyes open and realize it's, you know, I get very hermit like, you know, just in my own world a lot. And it's much safer. You know, it's like, you know, it's like the kid in your room.
Yeah.
Like this is kind of what this is here. I'm just the kid in my room, but you need to kind of see that. Yeah. That your art makes no sense to other people if you don't know other people,
you know,
or what other people are going through or what, you know, what the human experience is. It's just, I couldn't design something that people would like unless I heard, you know, like I said, like those experiences I had on the bus in London, you know, getting to know other people. It's just taught me about how to be a better designer, I believe, you know.
You know, you had said that, you know, you haven't reached the top of the mountain yet, which we'll call that success. What does that look like for you? When will you know that you have reached the top of the mountain? You've reached a level of success, or what does success look like to you?
It definitely means being paid well for expressing myself. Mm-hmm. And so I can also teach others. I love teaching. I have apprentices, and I want to be able to employ people and to take stuff out of my hands to teach my kids that, yeah, you can be an artist. You can make a living at it. So they can feel that that's an option. I mean, that's success to me as well as I mean, it's kind of cliche to say no, it doesn't matter. The money doesn't matter. You know what? It kind of does. It kind of, because it signals that you are connecting with something out there.
Yeah.
And you're not just doing, it's not the reason you make the art, but if you figure out something, like you have to like question yourself if you're just, especially if you want to leave a day job.
Yeah.
You have to figure that out. Yeah. It's not just, bread's just not going to appear from the sky. You have to really focus. And like, even if the struggle I had is like, you have to start with something that is a little bit you and then take the brave steps to make it more of you. So you don't have to just go out there and just make a bunch of paintings about your emotions that day and expect it to, you got to start something somewhat marketable.
Yeah.
Then, add your flavor to it and add a bit more. It's like your recipe. And then that process, because I've, like I said, I've had many in learning how to get this business off the ground, the failures of learning how to ship, the failures of, you know, like when it gets damaged, you know, and I try to do what I utmost to make it right and at the cost of me, you know, and then, but I believe that's the long game. And in marketing, you're like, you could, as an artist, you could spend so much time like comparing yourself to the successful people with more followers that aren't as good as you or not as talented. Like you can, that's so much energy wasted rather than focusing on what you need to do. And just, cause it's going to be, these are the days, like I believe in the creative entrepreneurialism, you're not trying to reach everybody. You're trying to reach those few who are going to be support you.
Yeah.
Cause there's too much noise out there. People want to hear something true, something real, something beautiful, something, you know, they want to give money to that.
Yep.
They don't, like people, there's so much fame out there now that nobody's famous anymore. Yeah. It's just like, you know, it lasts for 5 minutes. They just want real people.
Yeah.
They want to buy something from a real person. You know, that's why people, I think, buy from me rather than, you know, that a desk that can come from, imported from somewhere that serves the same purpose. It's at a fourth the cost. You know, they know they're going to be able to hand the thing I make to someone else and they can hand it to someone else. It's not going to wear out on them. And so success to me is just basically a continuing the climb and not stopping the climb, really, because I'm aiming for, like, Salvador Dali is one of my, you know, artistic heroes. You know, just the way he, you know, he was in the group of surrealists and I think they kicked him out. I think he kicked himself out, but it was mostly about he had a road to follow, a path to climb, and he did it till he was an old man to the day he died. He didn't stop, you know, and he was always Salvador Dali. And mine's different than his, but, you know, it's okay to bring the weird stuff out, and don't hide it.
So what do you, as we wrap up, as our time comes to an end, it has been an incredible journey to walk with you from your childhood to now and to see it all and to hear it all, I should say. You know, and there are people listening that are waiting to start their journey. They don't know what that is yet. And maybe they do, maybe they're just hesitant for it. There's a level of fear that they have, or maybe they don't know what it is, or maybe they've tried it before and they failed miserably at it. As we end our time, based on your journey, what are some words you want to leave those people?
It will be hard. It does add up, and it will multiply if you're at it, if you keep opening the door to it, keep making space for it, keep making room for it, keep it alive. It may change what it looks like, whatever the it is, you know, but the it is meant to benefit you and all the people around you, because people around you who know you want to see it, you know, and what that it is, it's there. It's already in you, and you know it. And just make space for it. And that could start with just putting a desk aside, not any desk, you know, it doesn't have to be expensive. Yeah. It can be any of them, you know, like I did one in my room when I was a kid. It's just like, it's okay, this is where I'm going to put my 4-track recorder and I'm going to start doing this. And that will become something.
Yeah.
But if you just think about it, it's not going to happen. You have to actually, reality is only changed by you like doing something different, like actually putting a physical thing somewhere, not by clicking on something, not by investigating. And that's part of it, but you have to actually put other things aside and put something there. I think that's a huge, it's a powerful thing to do. So even if you have a little apartment, if you make one corner or one coffee, it's like, but that's for this, for your it.
Yeah.
It'll become something.
Are you as self-aware as Brandon is? See, Brandon knew at a very early age that he was creative. He knew who he was. It just took him a decade or two to figure out exactly how to make a living out of it. But during that time when he was trying to figure it out, he stayed very close to those who did have it figured out so he can learn from them. There are so many narratives out there that will mislead you into thinking that finding success is a quick hit or an overnight endeavor. The only truth to the overnight success is that all overnight successes were preceded by hundreds of overnights. Last week, I posted a quote on the startupstory.co Instagram that read, "Know who you are, stay in your lane, be patient, and watch success come your way." I know this quote has resonated with you because the response to it has been one of our top Instagram posts to date. The key to it all, though, is knowing who you are. Once you've identified your strengths, your weaknesses, and your passions, it will be easy to stay in your lane and be patient with the process because you won't be deterred by the noise that surrounds us. I have so much respect for Brandon because he has stayed the course for the last 4 decades, and it's paying off for him now. But there's still room for us to rally around him and support him in his endeavors. I end every episode with an opportunity for our founders to provide me with a way that I can enlist the support of all of you to support them. If you've been around the Startup Story for a few episodes and you've heard me say, entrepreneurs support entrepreneurs. So when I asked Brandon this question, his response surprised me, but it really shouldn't have because it's so authentic to who he is.
I think what would be helpful for my business or any business that, because we come into that, what, in as far as the handmade areas, why does it cost so much or why is it so important? Is because we have so many options. And part of it is like, there's two things I ask. One, look into my work and you could probably see on my Instagram that what it's about is more than just making fancy furniture. There's a meaning to it because it's telling a story. And my grandfather used to make things that are still around. It's just like something well made is going to last beyond. And we're in a culture that wants to throw away once it looks old. And I would just, in a general sense, don't throw away something that looks old, especially if it's well made. At least pass it on. At least give it to somebody. At least try to fix it. At least, you know, try to fix something. Give it a, you know, there's, you'd be amazed at how what a little orange oil would do to something. So it's not necessarily like buy my stuff. It's just look at things different. It's like, look, we're such a throwaway society. So buy differently. Don't buy just, I realize there's times for IKEA. There's times for that. I have IKEA hacks. You know, you can't just, we're not in that position. But when you can be mindful about what's going in your home, just do that. And I say, look, follow some makers, who are doing this, and you will be inspired by that, and make something yourself. You know, buy some poplar. You know, you'll be amazed at what, like, how beautiful this wood is.
My additional ask is to help bring awareness to his business by following his Instagram at monkwood_. Again, M-O-N-K wood_. Like some of his photos, comment on some of them, even mention a few friends in some of the photos. Every founder I have spoken with so far in the Startup Story journey has talked about how challenging it is to get brand awareness out there. So let's show Brandon some appreciation for his time with us on this episode. Let's support a fellow entrepreneur. And now for my personal ask. The Startup Story community has been so incredible with sharing our podcast with others. But we have more stories to tell and more people to reach. We are a startup, and the most powerful way you can support the Startup Story podcast is to leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts. Follow us on Facebook and Instagram at thestartupstory.co. Share the startup story on your social media, either with a link or a screenshot. Make sure you tag or mention us at thestartupstory.co so we can see your help and say thank you for it. And lastly, share the podcast on your LinkedIn profile. The Startup Story is for entrepreneurs, so please do not underestimate the power of sharing the Startup Story on your LinkedIn profile so other entrepreneurs can discover us. In fact, most people struggle to share good content on LinkedIn anyways, so if you want to support the Startup Story, then search for the Startup Story company page, follow us, and share our posts to help encourage other founders and spread the word about the podcast. Every single founder has a story, and the startup stories we bring to you every week can encourage and inspire another founder. It might just be what they needed to hear to keep moving forward on their dreams. I look forward to sharing these stories every Tuesday with hopes to inspire you to start your story.